I've had several people that have come and said to me, boy, we're enjoying this sermon series. We have forgotten how much is in these classic accounts, classic Sunday school stories in the scriptures, and what there is still to learn from them as an adult. And we're going to find that to be the case again this morning as we look at one of these Sunday school type stories, Sodom and Gomorrah. The account we're going to run through, it's long enough that I'm not going to read the whole account, but I'm going to summarize the contents of the two chapters here, starting at Genesis 18. We have the biblical patriarch Abraham, who is visited, a surprise visit by three strangers. These turn out to be the Lord and two angels who come to him. And Abraham immediately swings into action and gets a huge meal prepared in a great display of hospitality. He has a calf that is killed and just prodigious quantities of flour that's supposed to be made into bread, would make dozens of loaves of bread. So there's this overwhelming meal that the Lord is wanting to be prepared for the Lord. Abraham wanted to be prepared for the Lord. And as this takes place, the Lord has two reasons to visit Abraham. One is to announce to Abraham that he is going to have a child. He had promised about 24 years earlier that his wife and he, Sarah and he, would have a child, and now it's been 24 years later, and it's just about time for that promise to be fulfilled. So he announces, this time next year, you will have a child. And that was the child of promise who would turn out to be Isaac, Abraham's firstborn of Sarah. So this is a very important moment, the announcement. Kind of interesting, kind of harkens to the Christian's mind the announcement of the angel in regards to Jesus. The angel comes and says, you will be with child. We don't have time to explore all those kind of interesting avenues today, but somewhat along the same kind of lines, God is going to announce a miraculous birth. The other thing that's taking place here is that the angels that are with the Lord are going to head down to Sodom. And this is a city steeped in wickedness that the Lord intends to destroy. When Abraham finds out that these angels are heading towards Sodom, he's greatly concerned because that's where his nephew Lot and his family are living. So then in chapter 18, verses 16 and following, there ensues a kind of bargaining session between Abraham and the Lord, whittling down the numbers of people that would be considered righteous in the city, and the Lord will spare the city if there are a certain number of righteous people to be found in it. Going on into chapter 19, the angels head off toward the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and we see another case of hospitality exercised here on the part of Lot. These two men come into the city square in the evening, and Lot makes sure that they don't have to spend the night in the public square. This hospitality is likely for the benefit of these strangers, not just to be nice so that they have a place to rest their head, but as we learn, it is to protect them because of the immorality, the wickedness and viciousness of the citizenry. And so Lot gets these guys off the street. They're in his house, but the townsfolk know that these men are there, and they come beating on the door of Lot's house, demanding that these men be handed over so that they may have sexual perversions with these men. In the end, these angels strike the wicked townsfolk, and they blind them. And then they tell Lot, now is the time. You have to leave now. If we were to start in verse 15, with the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished. When he hesitated, the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. We're going to comment on that a little bit later. But they do indeed flee the city, at which time the Lord sends down his fire, his destruction upon the city, wiping out the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah, and in fact, the entire plain in which they are located. That is the account in chapter 18 and 19. There's a lot to take away from this, starting with the fact of this despicable impurity and immorality of the people. Sodom will always live in infamy. The term sodomy, of course, is associated with homosexuality, and it is still a term that is used to designate that. This will always be one of the classic accounts of the perversion of human nature. And in association with that, nothing has changed. You know, we may see political climate and whims change in North America as to how we are supposed to perceive homosexuality and lesbianism. It will never change in God's mind. God's rules and principles are eternal. They don't shuffle and change and bend with whatever mankind's current cultural tendency is. This is going to not go away. The Lord is always going to consider homosexuality a perversion, an aberration, a distortion of his goodwill for humanity. And preachers of the true gospel will always say this, despite whether it's popular in culture or despite whether some judges deem it's legal or illegal, this is what's supposed to be preached. And I hasten to add that this means that we harbor no hatred toward individuals caught up in this sin. It's a direct example of the case that you hate the sin and love the sinner. You want these individuals to see God and to be redeemed out of this waywardness. But in no way is this going to be condoned. Never has been by the Lord, never will be. You know, in our current cultural climate, too, it's very popular now for people to take the excuse, well, it's genetic, I can't help it, you know, and I think it's Lady Gaga who even sings I Was Born This Way and tries to popularize this as though these individuals have every right to express themselves sexually this way. In response to that, I would simply say, well, there's all kinds of genetically based problems that humans face. There's all kinds of illnesses and disease and problems. I think that we should seek a genetic cure for homosexuality. I'm not joking. If there is a genetic component to it, we should be treating it like a disease, like the problem that it is. You know, the evolutionists try to suggest that humans are similar to animals. And look at the animal kingdom. There's all kinds of partner swapping activity and behavior that would be similar to homosexuality. And then they try to suggest that this is a basis to that it should be okay for humans too. We're just doing what our ancestors supposedly did, right? As though this is a big justification. There's a few problems with this. First and foremost, as a Christian, we never look at ourselves as mere animals. We are made in the image of God, and our behavior is supposed to distinguish us and keep ourselves separate from what the animals do. In no way, shape, or form are we supposed to live down to the standards of animals. Furthermore, if you were going to argue purely on the basis of an evolutionary materialist mindset, I don't think it could be said that it's advantageous to humans to practice homosexuality and lesbianism. After all, you don't get procreation. You don't get species surviving and having offspring through homosexuality. You have to take excessive steps of technology in order to get this kind of thing to happen. that should tell people that it's unnatural and not the most advantageous. What that does, it reminds me of the fact that this is a genetic aberration, if it is entirely genetic. Which leads me to my point. Then we should seek to eliminate it genetically. Why not find a cure for homosexuality so that these individuals can live their lives normally sexually? Well, that's just a little side point here. And I think that's pretty tight logic in this regard. But moving on, as we see this town, this city is steeped in this rebelliousness, this wickedness against God. I always find it humorous that homosexuals on the one hand say, I can't help it, I was born this way. But then if you make a suggestion like me, why don't we fix it genetically? Then they'll say, I choose to live this way. Oh, well, what happened to your, I can't help it? Now it's your choice. You see, this is the big problem. Humans are always going to look for some kind of excuse. They're always going to look for some kind of justification why they should be allowed to get away with what they're doing. It's never themselves. It's never their own wickedness and waywardness. It's always somebody else. The people in Sodom and Gomorrah were given over to wretched wickedness and impurity. And they sought to practice this with a vengeance. So when the angels of the Lord come into this town, Lot is trying to protect them from this. This is why he takes them into his home. So it's not just kindness and hospitality towards strangers. It's actually defensive mode that Lot is in. We're going to stop for a second and talk about these two interesting parallel accounts of hospitality. Hospitality was practiced in the ancient world as a matter of custom. It was a social thing as much as anything. When you traveled in the ancient world, you didn't have gas stations spaced conveniently every so often. You didn't have fast food shops or restaurants to go get a bite to eat. You might have to cover long distances of very, very barren terrain. Once in a while, there might be an oasis of some sort. But that was not the typical terrain. You might have to go for days and days with whatever provisions you had, and it was a tremendous blessing if you encountered a family or an outcampment where they would invite you in, give you something to drink, give you something to eat, and a place to stay, and perhaps something for your camel, for your donkey, if you had an animal. This wasn't just extravagance on the part of the person sharing. It was necessity. And if they themselves, the one who had provided this kindness, this hospitality to somebody else, were out on the road, so to speak, they would need this themselves. So this was part of the social structure of the ancient world, helping one another out, providing necessities so that people could travel about and conduct distance business in distant lands and things like this. So when Abraham sees these three strangers coming, it is just part of the culture of the day. But he knows there's something really special about this too. This isn't just anybody. This is the Lord. So notice that Abraham's not just going to provide hospitality. He goes way over the top. Kill a calf. Kill a calf to feed three guys? You know how many steaks that can make? And then you think about the bread, and we're talking dozens of loaves of bread worth here. What this is showing us is that the Lord is so crucial. Abraham wants to overabundantly welcome God to show his devotion to the Lord. That's a good lesson for us. If we want to invite God in and really welcome him, we're not going to give chintzy gifts. We're not going to be just providing a piddly little amount for God. We're going to be showing a great desire to welcome him. Now, when we get to Sodom and Gomorrah, and the angels are sent down to bring down the cities. And it's interesting because it discusses not just the cities, but the entire region. The entire plains are destroyed too. all the crops are taken out. It's complete oblivion. And the angels come into town. Lot shows his hospitality. Like we said, in this particular case, he's fearful for their welfare. So he takes them in to shelter them, to protect them. And here's where we see that nasty wickedness of human nature. Sodom and Gomorrah will always stand for the absolute inability of human nature to reach limits when it comes to depravity and immorality. You've seen this in several of these accounts that we've looked at over the last few weeks. We've seen that humanity has an almost impossible limit to reach when it comes to wickedness. And you get humans together and it just gets worse. It's bad enough when you're dealing with a sinful human. You get groups of sinful humans together intent on evil and it just goes from bad to worse. So here these individuals are in this whole city is like a homosexual mecca. It's like this community that is based on wickedness. Lot has gone down there to live, not a smart choice, and he's down there, and Abraham has to come to his rescue. What's interesting is that God and Abraham start this exchange, and it's just like bartering in the Middle East. God is saying to Abraham, I'm going to go down and destroy the city of Sodom. Well, Abraham knows his nephew and his family live down there. So Abraham is going to come up with a deal with God. Lord, Lord, you're not going to destroy the righteous with the wicked. You know, this is one of these things that come up all the time when we've got Hurricane Katrina or we've got individuals in the Japan and Sendai and things like this. You know what? Would the Lord destroy the righteous with the wicked? So it was one of those questions. What's God doing here? Is God visiting with his vengeance? Is he going to take out seemingly innocent people? So Abraham says, what if there are going to be 50 people found that are righteous? Now, here's the really sad commentary on the situation. There aren't 50 righteous people in the city. Now, we don't know exactly how many people lived in Sodom. You can bet it was thousands. This wasn't a town of, 73 people. This was thousands of individuals in this region. Perhaps tens of thousands. And you can't come up with 50 decent people. Now that shows us the extent of the depravity of that area. You know, people have likened San Francisco or Las Vegas or New Orleans to Sodom. You know, I don't think we're quite at that point. If you were to take the percentage of people that are still somewhat godly and decent and aren't totally sold over to wickedness and sexual immorality, I don't think we're at that point in America. Are we sliding in the wrong direction? Yeah, I think so. And Christians are working furiously to try to prevent further sliding in that direction. But I don't think we're close to that. Because when it's all said and done, Abraham starts his bargaining thing, you know? And if you've ever been to a bazaar or a market in the Mideast part of the world, you realize bargaining is a big thing. It's as much social as anything. You go to a shop and you say, how much is this? And they say, oh, for you, $200. And you're like, oh, what a joke, you know? And that starts the bargaining. And you go back and forth. And a half hour later, you might get it for $20 if you're good, you know? So the thing is, Abraham is bargaining with God now. Oh, Lord, Lord, okay, your intent, in other words, God's got his deal set. He's going to destroy the city. Abraham's going to bargain for it. Oh, but wait, God, if you got 50 people, you're not going to destroy it for 50 people. Okay, we'll give you 50. And then Abraham's going to go, well, wait, maybe 40. And he's working it down. He gets down to 10 people. How corrupt and nasty is a culture when you can't find 10 people that are godly? That's why I'm saying I don't think America is close to that point. And God forbid we ever get close to that point. Because all we'd have to look forward to is the condemnation and destruction from God. You know, Christians are taking seriously this commitment that we be the salt of the earth, the light of the world, you know, that we're preserving our society and our culture, that we're working politically and individually to install godly president and cabinet, and that we're trying to reach out to our neighbors and warn them not to go the worldly route. We're doing this. And I think that is sort of like Abraham. We're kind of bargaining with God to save our country, save our culture. And he seems to be listening. He's not pulled the plug on America. God willing, he won't, for the sake of the righteous people here. But then you get to the inevitable, and the city is destroyed. God's vengeance will come, and it will be extreme. A lot of people that aren't familiar with the Bible are kind of taken aback when they first start reading it at how violent God's anger and justice can be. I mean, when he visits humans with his wrath, it is catastrophic, and the humans just are consumed. They are blown away like chaff. It's the same as standing in the way of an avalanche, just totally decimated. And when God uses all of his divine power and fury on humans, they're obliterated, annihilated. And a lot of people don't have enough respect for the pure anger and fury of God on sin. They don't understand this. And way too many people play the game as though, oh, sin's not that big a deal. I don't need to be right with God. Whatever. They're going to be absolutely destroyed. You look at images of God's judgment on sin in the scriptures, and they are absolute. They are complete and devastating. The flood takes out almost all of human life on this planet, with the exception of 8 people. And you see the way he deals with these cities, the vast majority are just destroyed. And God has to make no apologies for this. Because humans are his creatures, and he's told them how to live, and he's given them knowledge of him, and if they choose to disobey, it's on their own head. God has no wrongdoing in this. It's the humans that rebel and set themselves up against him and defy him. They deserve it. And so, you know, I'll tell you, one of the most amazing descriptions of God's judgment is in Revelation, where it describes, in one instance, the angel who is sent to harvest the earth with the judgment of God. He's described as having a sharp sickle. You know, in the ancient days, they used sickles to swing the sickle and to just cut off the crops at ground level for harvesting. And so the image is of this angel who has this sharp sickle, and he swings this sickle in God's judgment to harvest the earth. In other words, we're just going to lay them all out. And there's descriptions of the blood from the slaughter flowing as high as the horse's bridle. I mean, you're a fool if you want to stand in the way of God's judgment. As a sinful creature, if you want to try to defy the living God, you're an idiot. So Sodom will always stand with this kind of like nuking the town from the heavens. It will always stand as a symbolic moment of God's judgment upon unrepented sin. It's a stark warning to anybody that thinks they're going to play games with their life and they're going to get away with defiance of God. You won't. The judge of this universe will have his day on you. But there's something else that's very critically important, And that is, in the midst of all this devastation, we see all of this anger and venting his wrath upon these people. But it's also an interesting parallel that when these events take place, God is using that judgment as the very vehicle that he saves his people. So right when the majority are getting blasted, God is pulling out, in this case, literally pulling out the peoples he's saving. In fact, let's take a look at chapter 19 once again. And back to those verses I read a little earlier, verse 15. With the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished." Notice this. When he hesitated, the men grasped his hands and the hands of his wife and his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. I can't help but see a parallel that probably applies to every one of us. We're sitting in a culture that is steeped with immorality. We're sitting in a culture that is completely obsessed about its own happiness. We too have been tainted with this idea that we need to satisfy our appetites and desires, if not sexually, then maybe in terms of food and material objects. You know, there's an interesting reference, and we don't have to turn there. I'll just refer to it. In Ezekiel chapter 16, there's an interesting reference to Sodom, and we learn from that passage that one of the main sins for which God condemned the city wasn't just the immorality, it was gluttony. It was engorging oneself on food and material things and riches with no concern for the poor. The people in Sodom didn't give a rip for the needy. And that was one of the reasons God destroyed them. And you think about that in terms of our culture and the incessant drive to accumulate and this desire to satisfy every longing we have. And we have all of these miserable TV shows on clothing. And we have the homosexuals invading the style and fashion and telling us what we all have to wear to look fantastic for the world. And we have every cooking show under the sun to tell us, well, how we can get all such pleasure from what we eat. I'll tell you what, there's a lot of shades of Sodom in all this. As though life is nothing more than just gratifying and satisfying every desire we have. While we've got a world of people that are dying, literally dying of starvation. And do we give a rip? Do we lift a finger? Give something to save these people's lives. I tell you what, we got to think about that. More important, we better do something about that. You'd better be given something to save the dying in this world. If your faith means anything to you, you better be doing something. Making some kind of donation for the hungry and the real dying. And I'm not talking about the guy in our country who's got a car and a TV and an apartment and sponging off the government. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about people that are really dying, made in the image of God. We're closer to Sodom in some ways than we'd like to admit. And here's the thing. Lot when he is told by the angels, now, you leave now, hurry. What does he do? He hesitates. But, I got my house here. I got my car. I got my 401k. I got everything here. I can't just leave this all. Even when faced with complete annihilation, he hesitates. And here's where you see the true grace and mercy of God. The angels take their hands and lead them out. Because Lot didn't have the wherewithal to do it himself. And sad to say, that's probably how we're going to get to heaven too. We'd like to think we're just these really strong, victorious saints. We're just so full of the Spirit of God, and we're living the good, righteous life, and we're on the way to glory. And the fact of the matter is, probably we're stumbling and hesitant and staggering and can't even get the job done. And God has to grab our hand and yank us along to get us there, because we have too much love of the fleshly and the worldly and the social and all of the evils that God condemns. Even for the saints, it's really not a great assessment. God in the end just saves our butts, and it's just that simple. No wonder then people who really understand the situation realize that God deserves all the glory and praise for salvation, because you sure can't count on ourselves to do it. Sodom stands forever as two things. One, the immoral cesspool that is humanity, and how God is going to judge it completely. And two, the amazing, incredible mercy of God who would save anybody at all. Amen.